It was only racism that drove the war on drugs from its very beginning. The very first anti-drug laws were anti-opium laws against the Chinese in San Francisco, and the very first anti-cannabis laws were in El Paso, Texas, right in the border. You couldn't make Latino people illegal, but you could make their drugs illegal. And then Harry Anslinger, who was the one who kind of first weaponized the war on drugs in the 30s with the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, he's the one who's behind the famous Reefer Madness campaigns, but he has some quotes that are just hair curling about how weed makes low white women go for black men and how it causes more mixing of the races. And so he was actually censured for things he would say. They were too far out there even for the 40s and 50s. And then by the time it got to Nixon, there's an amazing money quote that Dan Baum found from Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's stooges. And it's a quote you can find all over the internet now, because it says, "We knew that we couldn't make being black or being against the war illegal. But we knew that if we linked those groups to heroin and to cannabis, then we could beat them up every night on the nightly news."
This time on the Plutopia podcast, writer, scientist, and lecturer Lex Pelger joins John and Scoop from France. We discuss the war on drugs, legalization and regulation of drugs in the U.S. and Europe, the endocannabinoid system, supernormal research, and his podcast, The Lex Files.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. And our news today will be in the form of a little bit of reality bending. Today, our guest is Lex Pelger, who's a writer, a scientist, a lecturer on cannabis, psychedelics, and the endocannabinoid system. And also, according to Eric Davis, Lex is a warrior of the weird. What a great characterization.
Yeah, I'll take that. Yeah, anything positive from Eric sounds good to me.
Cool. Well, you got two weird guys here to another weird guy, so
yeah, weird is our middle
really
name.
Weird today. And originally, so we were going to talk about UFOs, and that's kind of how Eric put us in touch with Lex. But there's a lot more to talk about. We'll probably get to UFOs at some point, but I just want to start. You know, my first question is kind of, and I know this will probably be a longish answer, but what's your background and how did it lead you to psychoactives?
Yeah, it's kind of nice because it's a pretty normal origin story for as far as drugs go. You know, I'm a writer, so I spent a lot of my life collecting people's drug stories, and mine is pretty standard, which is kind of sweet. You know, I grew up in a fairly conservative part of the country in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Amish country is what most people know. But I was always a scientist. I always felt like science was just how to view the world ever since I learned about genetics and Punnett squares and all that in seventh grade. And so when I got to college, you know, magic mushrooms were floating around. And I remember my very first adventure, and it was simply us eating a bunch of magic mushrooms and walking Boston's Freedom Trail, which is a great walk because it goes through a bunch of cool old districts and it's just nice. And there's that Russian drug writer, Viktor Pelevin. He says that your first good experience of psychedelics and sex will forever flavor the rest. And so my first psychedelic experience was walking with friends towards a nebulous destination. And it became the way I always like to do psychedelics, just outside with people, looking around, not too much with people that aren't on the same experience, but at least having them around. And so it was just very natural. And then, you know, got into some higher doses and found some more mystical experiences, even though I would have considered myself an atheist those days. And I just was fascinated by the whole experience and I wanted to learn more. And it's what I started writing about and doing a lot of background research by reading through the books, but then, and learning the science of the neurochemistry of how it works. But my angle as a writer became someone who knew the people who was out there doing these drugs and collected a lot of stories. And so, yeah, I knew what the science was showing about how these things worked in the lab, but I thought it was a lot more interesting to find out what burners might do over the course of a long week and how many drugs you can mix and how that goes, and the positives of it and the negatives of it. So I think I kind of became a professional devil's advocate. So to people like my parents, it'd be like, no, there's a lot to be said for these psychedelic drugs and things like this. And to all of the hippies and stoners, I'm like, wait, there's a lot more dangers here than you realize. Like, there's a reason ketamine is called the addictive psychedelic, and things like that. So that became my main focus for maybe the last 10 or 15 years now, was studying drugs in general.
Fact-based.
Fact-based, story-based. And then I decided I wanted to write my first book, and because you have to have a book, if you don't have a higher degree, at least you have a book. Where's your book? And so I decided I would do mine about cannabis. And that was actually my great hubris, because I said, it's weed. How long could it take? You know, a year, maybe two, and I'll have it all researched, all written, I'll be done. And that was 8 or 9 years ago. And it took me 5 years just to get the outlines of how big the endocannabinoid system is. And near the end of that time, that's when I first read Moby Dick. And that's what gave me finally the structure for all this material, because cannabis was just so hard to write about because it goes all the way back in human history. It's probably the first cultivated plant. It's certainly one of the first cultivated plants. And then every major empire deals with it. And then it's had such a vast influence this last century on all aspects of life. And then it's this amazing medicine. And we have this endocannabinoid system that the cannabis plant helped us discover. And to explain that neurochemistry using the whales of Moby Dick and the entire ocean as a metaphor for the human brain just worked so perfectly that it felt like it was coming from outside myself. And it was kind of my first instance of the muse being like, no, here you go. This is how you do it. You don't need to think about it too hard. This is going to work. And it just kept working better and better. So
it's not the first book I would have thought of as a metaphor for cannabis.
Yeah. I always take one big fat book along when I go on my big research trips. And this was the one, because they kept calling anandamide my great white whale, the first cannabinoid neurotransmitter. But I didn't know what that meant. And as I read this book, by the time I was 30 chapters in, I'm like, this is absolutely the book to use, because half of it's the whales, but the other half is Captain Ahab. And in my part of things, that is the war on weed. That's Harry Anslinger, that's Nixon, that's Obama. All of these people who just cracked down on the plant. That was the Captain Ahab side of things. So both sides of the book work so well to explain what it was I was trying to explain.
Now, why do you think there was so much angst among guys like Anslinger and Nixon and so forth about marijuana? Was it really weed itself that they were jacked up about, or did they have other motives for suppressing it?
It was almost only race. It was only racism that drove the war on drugs from its very beginning. The very first anti-drug laws were anti-opium laws against the Chinese in San Francisco. And the very first anti-cannabis laws were in El Paso, Texas, right in the border. You couldn't make Latino people illegal, but you could make their drugs illegal. And then Harry Anslinger, who was the one who kind of first weaponized the war on drugs in the 30s with the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, he's the one who's behind the famous Reefer Madness campaigns. But he has some quotes that are just hair curling about how weed makes low white women go for black men and how it causes more mixing of the races. And so he was actually censured for things he would say. They were too far out there, even for the 40s and 50s. And then by the time it got to Nixon, there's an amazing money quote that Dan Baum found from Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's stooges. And it's a quote you can find all over the internet now, because it says, "We knew that we couldn't make being black or being against the war illegal. But we knew that if we linked those groups to heroin and to cannabis, then we could beat them up every night on the nightly news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Absolutely. But did it work? It worked great. The war on drugs is not a failure. The war on drugs is doing perfectly exactly what it was designed to do and continues to do so. Even under Democratic presidents, it doesn't get that much bigger, but the machine roars onward. And then under Republican presidents in general, it gets even bigger. And it's still this racist horror show in all of these ways. And it doesn't seem like it's that close to ending, despite all of the legalizations happening.
Well, early in my career in radio news, I was working in Houston, and I got involved with a campaign to free a black activist, Leotis Johnson, who was became a big cause among activists because he was a leader in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a very essential part of the activist community in Houston. And he was taken out on a ride with some people he thought were his friends. Turned out they were undercover cops, and they offered him a joint. He smoked the joint, and he was arrested and sentenced to 40 years in prison. And that's when I went through the documents on this, it's like, this is a good example of exactly why they have the anti-cannabis laws, especially in Texas. Texas has a very horrifying history of oppression via the war on drugs. So how do you see it getting past the whole racial part of this war on drugs? Because it seems to still be going on, even though there's a big push in both conservative and progressive circles to stop it and to legalize recreational marijuana, at least.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it might be above my pay grade to how to truly end this thing in ways that make sense. But at least I can take a stab at parts of that are being solved now. And letting the prisoners out is a huge part of this that is surprisingly hard to do. You see across all these states are different activist attorney generals who are trying to get cannabis prisoners out of prison. And it's interesting how often the recreational legality roars ahead with mostly rich white guys getting a cut of these new markets, and then the historically disadvantaged groups not getting it. There's equity programs that are not terrible in Massachusetts and California and places like that. But so often there's a small equity program that kind of works, kind of doesn't, and still the people who are in prison for cannabis stay there. And that's the first thing that needs to change in this. And unfortunately, I think the rest of the fight is a whole bunch of activists doing a bunch of work to roll back all of these individual laws all over the country. It's amazing what Joe Biden could do right now if he chose to, and for some reason is not, even though, like you said, it's such a popular issue right now. He's just got his hands full uniting people. He does. There's a lot going on. And drugs is the thing that I am focused on. So that's, I'm not exactly a one issue pony, but it's my most important issue. But it is something I hope to see easing in my lifetime. There's a lot of good people doing work on it, but it's amazing how slowly it is happening.
Yeah, there's a lot of friction out there. I've been in states where marijuana had been legalized, but they were slow to create a structure for legal distribution. Dispensaries couldn't be set up because they didn't really have the laws in place or the regulation in place for that. And nobody kind of knew how the taxation part was going to work. And there's always this question, if you have a marijuana business, about banking your money and using banks, and there has to be like workarounds for that. So there's a lot of friction there that's making it hard to launch. But at the same time, state after state is passing legalization.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy to see, and the legalization is so often ugly. It's nice you see all these states touting how much money they're making off the cannabis market, but that's taxing something that shouldn't be taxed outrageously high. The taxes on cannabis make everything else pale, even luxury and vice taxes like alcohol and things like that. And it's too bad. There's a lot of medical patients that just get their weed from the recreational markets because that's really the only way they can get it done. And they're paying high taxes on the only thing that works for them as a medicine. And it does make this stuff really sticky. Yeah, it's a medicine, but it's also a great intoxicant. It's also an industrial product. And how exactly to engineer that is really tricky. I'm glad I'm not personally writing the laws on this, because I know people are, and it's just so complicated. I do think that medical patients are people often getting left behind. That's why I appreciate the work of places like Americans for Safe Access. For many, many years, they've been pushing to try to make sure state laws don't forget the medical marijuana patients who need this to be clean and untaxed. I know one possible solution is to have a recreational market that's not that heavily tested and is heavily taxed, and then you have a medical market that is not taxed, and the products are kept to a much higher level of purity. But in general, when you have a medical market, usually once the recreational market comes along, that eats up the medical market. Depending on how the laws are set.
Texas has a rather strange medical market that it's so regulated that it's almost impossible for someone to get approved to get the it's not really recreational marijuana. They have, you know, some you can get oils and such, but a perfect example of how badly they've regulated cannabis and hemp occurred recently, because in the news today we found out that one of the people that was a lobbyist for our commissioner of the Department of Agriculture, which was in charge of hemp production, was bribing people and shaking down investors who wanted to open hemp farms. And he was telling them that they needed to invest $150,000 before they could get a hemp license. Turned out the license is only like $300 or $400. And so they finally got onto hemp. But that's fairly common in all these regulatory structures, that the temptation to do something really evil is there all the time. And a lot of people are taking advantage of that. Do you see that kind of thing happening in Europe?
I don't see it in Europe. I'm also not as well connected here. I did hear about that Texas case today, and it's terrible. It also makes me chuckle because I'm fascinated by corruption. And it is true that in one sense, America has very low levels of corruption compared to much of the world, because it's simply legal to bribe people here. I mean, you can just give senators money. Most places in the world, you can't do that. So you don't need to bribe a senator. You simply make a donation to them. And that often happens with these kind of things, especially around the newly emerging vice markets like this. All over the country, you hear about bribes happening, about corruption, because it's brand new stuff. Nobody quite knows how it works. Oftentimes, the people who wrote the laws have now gone through the revolving door and now working as lobbyists or as fixers or rainmakers or something like that. And it's just a perfect storm for allowing this kind of corruption. And the FBI can only do so much. Usually it's the FBI going after this. And, you know, it's not their highest level priority. You know, it's not gigantic shakedowns as far as political corruption goes. And so for every case like this that makes it above board and we get to hear about, you know, it's hard to imagine there's not 10 or 20 other ones where the people just didn't get too greedy. They just, you know, were corrupt enough, but not too corrupt. I think it's generally the way to do it. Here in Europe, it's quite hard. I'm actually in France, and France is the most backwards of the large European nations. They're the ones trying to keep CBD illegal. They're just starting to talk about the medical cannabis thing a little bit, but it's still too far out there. It's a very conservative country, and they're the reason that they're making it hard for the rest of the EU to even have CBD as something that's legal.
That raises a question, because you mentioned before how the war on drugs in the U.S. is tied to the, I guess you'd say, racial war or suppression of race. But in France, they're sort of famously not very racist, right? I mean, does it have anything to do with race there, or is it a different thing?
They are. They're just more genial about it. And it's not black people, it's Moroccan people. It's North African people. And that's the people who are selling by the rivers, and they're the ones that are, you know, get caught when people do get caught. But they don't keep racialized data. It's not part of the culture. It's not part of their data collection system. So you don't know exactly who's getting arrested as much. But from, you know, what you can tell, it's more North African people. You know, there's a long history of a deep racism here. that that goes far back, you know, about being French. And, you know, you have to eat French food, which means that you're not eating Moroccan food. So there's a lot of pushback here as well. But it is more sane. There's just less beating the shit out of people you don't like as well. I mean, that happens. French cops are tough, too. But it's not, you don't have this gun culture where people are getting shot all over the place either. So it has been a nice place to raise a family. It'll be interesting to see how the cannabis world evolves here for me. I'm still buying my weed down by the river.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm guessing you can't just walk into a dispensary there and buy a bag.
Yeah, nothing yet. But you can buy, there's a really big market in actual hemp, in actual flower hemp. So high CBD, low THC hemp, you can walk in these stores and you see, jars filled with all these different types of beautiful cannabis. It's just not going to be enough to get you high. But if you like smoking CBD, which people here really do, there's not a big CBD oil market. It's more smokable CBD. And that's what the government wants to make illegal. Actually, they want to make smoked hemp illegal because it makes it too hard to know what's illegal marijuana and what's legal smokable hemp.
Yeah, but there's actually a CBD market here. And that's one thing that you're actually finding things that look kind of like marijuana dispensaries here in Texas, but they're really CBD basically is what they're selling. And I'm not sure exactly what constraints there are around that. I know there's one issue with CBD that is really not a legal issue, but just a medical issue, in that it's sort of like grapefruit. And the way it can, if you're taking certain drugs, then it can change the way those drugs are processed in the liver, and you can get a greater dose. So people have to be careful in taking CBD. I can't take CBD because of one of the drugs that I take. And I don't think that information has been widely disseminated, or how that will affect CBD use, but just overall, I think that the atmosphere in Texas is changing. Of course, the demographics of Texas are changing too. And we may well see legalization here within some number of years, probably not too far out. Especially, there's a growing understanding in the U.S. that you can tax, as you mentioned, you can have these exorbitant taxes and make a lot of money for your state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's true. And just to add on the CBD and drug interactions, it's a great point you bring up because it isn't well known enough that CBD can decrease the some enzymes called the CYP450 enzymes in the liver. And those are, it's an important whole enzyme class, and they process the majority of the drugs that go into your system. They either remove them or they activate them and make them work. And CBD can deactivate some of those enzymes or make them not quite as strong. That being said, I do know the studies aren't great in humans about how much CBD is actually going to be interacting with medications. And I know one doctor friend who says, listen, below 100 milligrams, I'm not really worried about drug interactions. But he's also a very science-based guy, and he says, this is just from what I see in my practice. I cannot find any really great data to say exactly where this line is going to be. And that's why it makes it tough for the FDA to regulate CBD, because they want some kind of number of like, just don't take more than this per day, and that's a safe level. And there just isn't numbers like that. There's what's safe, how much, the Australia came up with the number 40 milligrams per day. It seems like a pretty good number. But the FDA at this point has simply said, we're not going to touch this. We think this is a drug, and we are not going to regulate the market at all. So they're basically just stepping out and leaving the industry to hang and leaving consumers to hang. But they're busy too. It's also been 3 or 4 years, but they're busy too right now.
So yeah, recently we've had controversy in the CBD market in Texas over Delta 8 THC. And they, the state unilaterally just decided, well, that's illegal too. So, and they lost that battle in court, and they, the court said, no, it's not covered by any existing laws. So until there's legislation, Delta 8 is okay. Have you had any experience with Delta 8? It was new to me.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried a little bit years ago. And it's nice. It's a, you know, it's a way to get high. It hits your CB1 receptors, not quite as strongly as Delta-9 THC. Some people prefer it to the regular Delta-9 THC. Most people don't. They take Delta-8 because it's there and it's legal. And it is very controversial right now. In one sense, you could say legally that anything that's derived from hemp is legal. And Delta-8 THC is derived from hemp. And so you have a decent argument there. But then all of these state legislators are getting themselves in a twist because it's a way to get high that's legal. And so different states are coming in and interpreting this in different ways. And some are making it illegal and some are saying, no, this is fine. This is an okay thing. And it is funny because in any well-made CBD extract, you're going to have regular Delta-9 THC as well. And so if you were a high school kid with your parents' credit card, you could walk in and buy a good full-spectrum hemp extract and drink the entire bottle. That should be enough for you to feel the equivalent of smoking a joint. And so there are even some lawyers who are saying, well, you can just derive Delta-9 THC from hemp and then it's legal, which is, you know, seems like a decent argument. It's not flying anywhere, but it is interesting to see how there is this demonization of psychoactivity. Like just because it twists people's head, then it's illegal or shouldn't be allowed, which is funny because the two biggest head twisters in the world are alcohol and caffeine, and those are both legal, and alcohol causes more harm than almost any other drug. And then we have tobacco, which is the number one killer via drugs. Nothing else even compares the number of smoking deaths each year. I think the number is like 150,000 are dead from cigarettes each year, and then 75,000 for alcohol. And then everything else is, you know, is a handful compared to those two. Really, there's only two drugs killing Americans, and it's alcohol and tobacco. And I believe if you made everything else legal, those still wouldn't compare. Those, you know, if people want to use any of these drugs, they can right now.
Yeah, people don't realize also how much caffeine affects them. But Michael Pollan recently, in preparing to write about caffeine, decided he would stop caffeine for a few days. You may be aware of this. And it nearly took him down. He found out that he practically couldn't exist without caffeine. He was so addicted to it and had so adapted to it. So caffeine is much more powerful than we realize, and we don't even think of it as a drug.
That's true. And we never come off of it, you know, and I've come off of it the last couple of weeks because my whole family's going through COVID and we're just getting over it now. So drinking alcohol, drinking caffeine just didn't appeal to me. And I forget how different it is. You know, I'm just a more regimented person, and I'm not a terrible father on it, but I'm a little bit more like doing stuff and a little bit less willing to just sit there and like chill with the kids. I'm kind of like, okay, let's go do something. I don't know where to go. And it's funny that many of us just never do not have caffeine in our system anymore. And it's a reasonable experiment for anyone out there. I mean, I try to give up stuff sometimes. It goes okay. I keep coming back to cannabis. My wife eventually is like, don't you want to go down the river, buy some weed, you know, maybe improve your mood a little bit? Oh, okay. I'm being that much of a jerk. All right. Well, I guess I'll go buy some weed. It is funny how many psychoactives we have in us, and we just don't even think about them anymore. They're so normalized when for much of human history, it wasn't easy to get psychoactives.
That's a good segue to the next question I've got, which is about the endocannabinoid system. How does it work, you know, and how do we hack it?
How do we hack it? That's a good question. Running, for one. It seems like the runner's high is actually mediated by endocannabinoids. It's not endorphins. That's an old, they can't really find evidence that it seems like when you get high from running, it's the anandamide. So the quick breakdown for people who haven't heard of the endocannabinoid system is that, you know, there's this century long time when scientists couldn't figure out how weed got people high. And they were especially interested in this because weed affects people in such different ways. You take something like alcohol, it usually has the same effects. Most drugs typically affect most people in the same kind of way. But weed makes everybody react differently. Some people get angry, some people get sleepy, some people get joyful, some it knocks them out. And how could a drug have so many different effects? And so they didn't solve the problem until the early 80s when they found the first receptor, the CB1 receptor. And the story goes is that Lynn Howlett, the scientist who discovered it, she was using a radioactive probe for the CB1 receptor, and she applied it to a pig brain. And the stain came back, the radiograph came back almost completely black over all the top parts of the brain. And so she thought that the probe was wrong. It was binding all over the place. But it turned out it was correct. It's that the CB1 receptor is so widespread across all the highest areas of the brain and none of the lowest areas. That's why you can't overdose on weed. But because everyone has different CB1 receptor levels in different areas of your brain, it explains why people have different effects to it. You might have more in a certain region, and that's why you get more sleepy with it. And it's a CB1 receptor that the THC is actually binding to get people high. Soon after that, they found the CB2 receptor, which it tends to be, there's some found on every organ in the body, and it's mixed up with the immune system. And because there were two receptors there, we knew that there had to be something that bound them too. The brain wouldn't be making these receptors and just waiting for humans to wander out of Africa and start smoking the shrub in the Central Atlas Mountains or Central Asian Mountains. And so they eventually found the ligand that was binding this, and the first one was called anandamide. And it is the first endocannabinoid neurotransmitter we found. And it has a different structure than THC, but it does a lot of the same things, just on a shorter time scale. And they named it Ananda because that is the Sanskrit word for bliss. And it is one of the three holy words in the Sanskrit language. So you could call anandamide our bliss neurotransmitter. The one they found soon after that was the 2AG neurotransmitter. So those are the four biggest pieces that we know the most about in the endocannabinoid system is the CB1 and CB2 receptors, and then the anandamide and 2AG neurotransmitters that bind to them. We now know about another half dozen or so neurotransmitters that are endocannabinoids, and we suspect that there's a couple of more receptors there, but it takes a long time to prove a receptor as CB3 or CB4, but that might be coming. The thing about the endocannabinoid system is it's so widespread. It turns out the CB1 receptor is the most common receptor of its type in the human brain. So that's it's a really big deal if you're into neuropsychopharmacology. And the endocannabinoid system is very, very mixed up in our hormonal system, our immune system, and our neuronal system. So the three biggest, most mysterious, most arguably things that make us human, these three systems, the endocannabinoid system seems to be where they meet, and it influences all of them. And so it's often seen as a homeostasis system for the body. It works very well in balancing things out. And so, for instance, when you're taking CBD, if you're in pretty good shape, it often doesn't help that much. But if you have something that is out of whack, it seems like the CBD or whatever cannabinoid you're taking tends to go where the problems are and help smooth things out there. And that's why you hear about cannabis for such an incredibly wide array of diseases. You know, in California, they had the early medical marijuana movement. Dr. Todd Micaria was the cannabis doctor hero, and he would simply write down people's anecdotes. He was a good doctor. He knew what their problems were, and he wrote down all the diseases that he saw it work for. And he had an incredible list of something like 200 different diseases where nothing else was working, and then people just tried smoking a joint or taking some cannabis oil, and it did work. And that's one of the reasons I'm using Moby Dick to explain all of this, is because I have so many different diseases to get through where we have all of this good evidence. And some of it's preclinical evidence, some of it's only in animals, but you combine that with a whole bunch of people's stories saying that it works for them, and I think you're starting to get somewhere, even though the clinical studies often aren't done because it's really, really hard legally to study cannabis. And so often you'll see reviews being like, oh, well, we're not sure it really works for pain. It's like, okay, fine. But have you ever listened to anybody talk on this planet? I've toured the country so many times. I've answered the phones for CBD companies, and you just hear that over and over again. Pain and sleep and inflammation. Those are the three things you hear about with CBD, as well as other cannabinoids that are trying to help the system. So that is using different cannabinoid options out there and all the different ways you have to ingest them, that's really the way to start hacking the system. There's so many different dosages, there's so many different cannabinoids, there's so many ways to take it in your system. But the cool part is, once you find the way that works for you or for your elderly relatives, you can usually stick to that and just keep doing it, and that help will keep on coming. To most of the important parts about the cannabinoids, tolerance doesn't develop. I mean, it does develop to the psychoactivity effects. You have to, you know, you don't get stoned. After 10 years of smoking pot, you don't get stoned in the same way as you did when you were a kid. But for a lot of the important health effects, cannabinoids simply keep on working.
Yeah, my wife has multiple sclerosis, and she was an early user of the California medical marijuana card. And I was, you know, at that time, you know, I wasn't all that familiar with, you know, the effects of MS, and it's being greatly affected by cannabis. And I watched as she, because she was having a lot of pain, a lot of seizures, and the minute she started taking the medical marijuana, which was high quality, it was like she was a different person. She was not in as much pain. And I tried to explain this to more conservative people out there. It's like, no, that's, you know, you're just imagining it. You're just, you know, it's just wishful thinking. It's like, oh, okay, whatever. But it's beneficial. And you mentioned Todd McAree. I had the pleasure of meeting Todd a number of times, and I went in. I covered his testimony before the state legislature about the medical marijuana initiative, and he was up there. There was another guy, Hardin Jones, I think it was the other side of the argument, and somewhere I have a tape of their exchanges, and it's just amazing when you hear this doctor, you know, giving all these facts, and then you have this, you know, political hack just, well, no, it's all the minorities, and then, you know, it's going to cause our kids to, you know, whatever.
Causing to turn black.
Yeah, kind of. I used to hear that. You know, growing up in the South, you know, you smoke marijuana, you're gonna be listening to race music and you know, letting them move in next door. It's like, come on.
Oh, people. I'll confess to that. It does sort of lead you to listen to race music.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the first times I got high, I got introduced to James Brown. It's like, wow, okay. So maybe there's something to that myth.
Yeah, or the old thing that it makes you gay. yeah, which then you have the great activist in San Francisco, Brownie Mary and Dennis Perrone. And Dennis Perrone found both cannabis and gay love in Vietnam when he was over there serving. And so, I mean, the idea was, yeah, it did make him gay, and God bless him. The cannabis gave him the, I think, the self-awareness and the bravery to finally do something he always wanted to do. And so the idea of cannabis making you queer, being like, all right, yeah, uncover it, baby.
Well, you've talked about...
I mean, there's something to be said for any of a number of ways of changing your mind, right? In the sense that Michael Pollan talks about how to change your mind. If you can derail your train of thought a bit and let yourself go down a different path, then it opens doors.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just interrupted Scoop, I think.
Well, you were talking about, you know, scientists being involved in the study of cannabis and other drugs. And early on, when I was in San Francisco, I met scientists who were actively involved in testing of cannabis. That's when they were spraying paraquat on the Mexican marijuana harvest. And it turned out that was a very, you know, harmful substance, you know, if you smoked it. And these people formed a collective of people who would go out and get samples of the various marijuanas that were for sale in the Bay Area, and they would test them. They had lab tests where they could tell if this particular strain had been paraquated. And I just found that to be just a heroic effort, because these were people working for big organizations, big companies as chemists, and they were willing to, you know, go out on a limb and say, well, you know, we need to test because this may kill people.
Wow. Wow, that is brave. Yeah.
We need more
crazy
of that.
Time.
We need more scientists taking those risks.
You know, I want to shift gears here a little bit. And in order to shift gears, I will show this, which is the Lex Files, which is your podcast. And this particular podcast that I have up now is where you talk to Eric Davis about UFOs as spiritual objects. Mm-hmm. And we did say that we would talk about this a little bit today. And I'm just kind of wondering how you got connected to Eric and how you came to discuss UFOs, how you got an interest in that particular subject. Because, mm-hmm. you know, clearly you're deeply into all the other things that we've been talking about, and this seems to be kind of a new path that you're taking. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. As far as my connection with Eric, I believe we just met through the psychedelic world over the years. I don't quite remember exactly the first meeting, but just always enjoyed each other's company. And so I'd interview him on various projects, and we'd trade sci-fi ideas back and forth. Now we're all about GPT-3, the neural language AI, and the possibilities there. And so I interviewed him about this, but then even more influential, his book, Technosis, is an amazing book. It was one of my first exposures to this kind of thinking. And his UFO chapter always stuck with me, because I realized he never quite answered the question of what he believed or anything like that. And I was curious what he actually believed. And so it piqued my interest. I didn't know much about, oh, there's Technosis. Great. Yeah, I have a different edition right down there. And so it never really left my mind. And UFOs were something interesting as a scientist, because they were there and people kept talking about them. But the person who really changed it in a big way for me was Dr. Jeffrey Kripal. And it was actually, it was a friend here in France that I'd met through Eric, Laurent Coisy, a writer here and a Philip K. Dick expert. And he talked about Dr. Jeffrey Kripal's work. And if you haven't read him, he is just this amazing writer out of Texas, out of Rice University. And he had a transformative experience when he was in India with a Hindu deity. And it always stuck with him. He felt like his books were kind of downloaded into him then. And he's just this magnificent writer. And he focuses on the supernormal, is how he likes to refer to it. And yeah, there he is. I was told that would be a great person to interview. So I bought a bunch of his books and started reading, and I was blown away at what a good writer he is, for one, because I appreciate that as a writer myself. But he was just so level-headed about how much data is out there on everything that we call paranormal, on the UFO stuff. And all of a sudden I'm reading this and I'm realizing, wait, this is science. This isn't just stories from people. Scientists have been attacking this problem. And to me, the most fascinating part about it is, for most of these topics, you could look at nothing after the year 1900 and find yourself convinced. And that really intrigued me. For early work, you have the Society for Psychical Research out of London. A lot of famous people are involved in that, including William James, who is, you know, one of the greatest American thinkers of all time, the father of American theology. And he believed in this stuff. He saw all of these stories. The Society collected these stories from mediums about getting information in other ways, in ways that just don't make any sense. And yeah, this stuff is very hard to test in a scientific manner. But once you collect hundreds of stories from people who often don't want this to be true, where things happen to them that they don't want to explain or don't know how to explain, and they're embarrassed to bring up. And on the UFOs specifically, all you have to do is look up the great UFO wave of the 1890s. It was a concert, I think, in New York State. But in the 1890s, before humans had put anything in the air, there's no jets, there's no planes, there's no nothing up there. You have hundreds of newspapers across the country reporting from thousands of witnesses seeing all kinds of these classic UFO phenomena. And, you know, there, you, how do you explain that? You know, do you just want to dismiss it and say all of them were hallucinating? Or do you want to be more honest and say, here's a whole bunch of people with nothing to gain from this? And it's interesting that you can find that same kind of evidence for things like reincarnation. Their work of kind of UVA by Stevenson, Dr. Ian Stevenson, was the first scientist to start collecting these stories. But when you have a kid who says, no, I came from this place over here and I can tell you all about it and gets all the details right before they ever go to that place, and then they get there and everything's confirmed, you get enough of those stories and you start to realize something's really happening there. And so to me, it just got so fascinating because it's finally something new. In a sense, I've been reading science for, you know, my entire adult life, and all these new fields, it's like, oh yeah, of course that's the way things work in this part of ecology or cosmology or whatever. But it stopped being, it all kind of seemed like, yeah, things would go that way. There's certain patterns to the universe and they replicate at the cellular level and the ecology level and the galactic level. And all of a sudden, this super normal stuff is finally something brand new that we don't have great theories about, but is happening. Just like something similar would be electromagnetism. The idea that magnets could be affecting electricity seemed like a crazy idea when it was first happening. And all the early experiments seemed crazy. But it finally led to the breakthrough that, yeah, electromagnetism, they're pieces of the same puzzle. And I think that the quantum revolution of the last centuries helped people understand that all of these crazinesses that are happening at the quantum level, they might be scaling up and happening here at the human level as well. And so for me, Dr. Kripal's work and building off Dr. Eric Davis's work was really influential, because I'm like, this is what I want to write about next. So I have another probably 5 or 10 years to write the rest of the Moby Dick chapters on the cannabis stuff, because I'm doing 135 books based on the 135 chapters of Moby Dick. So I have three done. You can see them on lexpelger.com right now, but I still have 132 more to go. But they're all done. I got them. They're in my head. It's just have to write them and do them. But now I'm doing the research phase for my next set of graphic novels and like long piece, which is going to be this history of supernormal research. And it's fun because it really feels like it gave me a purpose. And most importantly, it's not just a disinterested scientific thing. It's very, very much linked to my spirituality and my sense of purpose. And actually, to explain that, I think could be helpful, because before I knew about any of this, I found a spiritual movement that really made a lot of sense to me, and this stuff ended up dovetailing into. And it's called Spiritism, not spiritualism. That's more the table tapping and that kind of stuff of the Fox sisters 150 years ago. But Spiritism was a specific movement by this guy who called himself Dr. Alan Kardec. He was a French theoretician of educational theories and very influential in France. I think 120, 40 years ago, something like that. And he was fascinated by all the spiritualism happening. These mediums were talking to spirits at parties and stuff like that. And funny stuff was happening. And Kardec said, well, I don't care about, you know, funny stuff. I want to know this, what matters in life. And so he came up with a big list of the most important questions in life, like why we're here, how does all of this work, what happens after you die, what's good, what's evil. Really beautiful questions. Sometimes the questions is the hardest part. And he sent these questions to all of the top mediums around the world. He built up a big network. And so he got answers back from dozens and dozens of mediums who were communicating their answers from the spirits they were said to have been talking to. And Kardec said, what matters is the pudding. Is the proof in the pudding? Does this stuff sound real? You know, whether it's coming from the humans or whether it's coming from beyond, how does this sound? And the answers he got back, not only were they really, really well done and I think insightful, they also very, very much matched up to each other. All of these spirits and mediums who had no idea of each other, weren't communicating, came up with the same general idea of what's happening. And it's an idea of spiritual evolution. that this material world is one that our souls come into because this is an easy place to learn lessons. And even before we come into this world, we kind of get a general idea of the lessons we want to learn. So the bad things that happen in your life, you kind of decided before you got here, I need to learn this. In my spiritual tradition, my head spirit is associated with the ocean. And here I am being a father and feeling like the biggest lessons I'm learning right now are about parenting. And so to Spiritism, we're here and we are trying to constantly evolve. And it makes a lot of sense because you hear that from all of these major religions. I mean, the majority of the world believes in reincarnation and that you keep coming back to learn these things and that there are spirits that are here to help you. And that was my first exposure to these kind of ideas. And the writing was beautiful. The ideas were beautiful. So it felt like it gave me a purpose. And then I start reading about UFOs. I start reading the channeled materials that people say they're getting from UFOs. And it matches up. It has the same kind of explanations for what's going on here. I'd recommend the Ra material if you're into this. Ra, the Egyptian god. There is a group who they were using telepathic communication and he was simply speaking through them. And there are two volumes of this material and it lined up with what the spiritists were saying. And to me, it made a lot of sense that we're these three-dimensional beings and we're trying to evolve into four-dimensional beings. And eventually there's something higher and higher, sixth, seventh, eighth. But that stuff's kind of above the abyss. That's what I really like about a lot of these books. Whenever they say, listen, there's parts here you're not going to be able to figure out yet. You know, it's Aleister Crowley talked about that. For the first three numbers, the first three sephira of the Tree of Life, those are above the abyss. We don't get to understand what God means, what the duality of male and female means, what the Trinity is in all of these different religions. Like we can play with it and kind of figure it out, but it's always going to be above our pay grade during this phase of what we're doing. Really, it's pretty simple what we're supposed to be doing. It keeps coming back to love, taking care of others. You know, for as much fun as it is to be reading all of these books and getting high and reading about mysticism, and I put all of these notes on my walls, but all the notes just keep pointing back at me and saying, go inward, learn about yourself, get more of your shit out of the way and be a better husband. Stop being quite as much a jerk to your wife. Be a better, more patient father to your kids. Like, let's focus on the stuff that you can handle. These big, crazy questions are nice. They are kind of intellectually stimulating, but really they should be pushing you towards fruits of the spirit. And that's what I really liked about all of this stuff is that it seemed to have a concreteness that mattered, that could really inform all of our lives.
You know, sometimes a mystery is just a mystery and it's not going to be anything else, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Dostoevsky said, if the universe were sensible, nothing would ever happen.
Do you meditate?
Some. I have an app that's been helpful. It's a more insightful one. It's called Bright Mind, recommended by Stan Tatkin, the great relationship guru. I wish I meditated more. It's actually in the raw material. That's one of the things it says over and over again to the humans. He's like, he often in that stuff is like, you know, we've gone over this. And really the main thing is be more service to others and meditate. This is a funny idea. I don't know if this stuff is true or not, but according to the raw material, there are lots of different spirit entities out there that are trying to help us and they can be invited in. But if we don't invite them in, they won't help. Just like Jesus said, knock and the door shall be opened, but you don't knock, door doesn't open. But according to the raw material, certain species have set up like repeating units of messages here on the earth, just because humans keep asking the same things over and over again. And it's just, and the spirits don't have time to keep repeating the same things when all they really need to say, yeah, meditate more, be kinder to each other. Okay, we're just gonna put a radio on with this message and let that on repeat because you're not getting it, but you keep asking. So we'll just put this repeater unit here for you.
Well, the thing about meditation is that if you're just dealing with the applications and you never get into the operating system, you don't really understand the computer very well. You may get stuff done, but you don't really even have a good handle on why, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So yeah, anyway,
I think meditation and therapy are really important for anyone who wants to dive into this kind of stuff. Aleister Crowley said, before you get into practicing magic, or doing any of those kind of things, you need to have a PhD level equivalency in about 8 major subjects. You need to know science and history and psychology. You need to understand a lot about quantum mechanics these days. That, and according to the Hasidic Jews, you should never study mysticism and really start working at it until you hit the age of 40. And I'm only 38 right now. So I'm not really trying to read about this stuff to get an intellectual background in it. But I also feel like it's a long, slow path and I'm supposed to take it slowly. And I'm supposed to have a better base built up as a generally decent human being. I definitely should not have been doing this stuff at 25. And I still feel like I'm not quite ready for it. But I think my kids are helping to train me into being a slightly better person and that this will help.
Well, you know, one point there is that you can get all a PhD in a number of sciences and you can become an expert in a number of things. But if you do all that and you don't know your own mind, then, you know, you're still kind of lost. You know, you're just lost in all that stuff. You're lost in your expertise, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. The curse of expertise. You see it a lot in the science world now. You're such an expert in your tiny domain, but there's no grand synthesis thinking. I also think it harks back to a problem that we're now experiencing that we've experienced before that you might call the end of science. The Greeks had this problem. They got kind of the end of what they could solve at that moment. And the world hadn't changed. They knew a lot more about geometry and they had better guesses about atomic theory and things like this. But it didn't make anybody better people. It didn't fundamentally change our purpose in life. And I feel like we have that same problem now. We have this religion of scientism, of science will solve all problems, but it isn't. Now there's more to learn in any direction than any one human can ever figure out. You know, any field is going to be a fractal that goes on forever. And it still doesn't explain to us why we're here and how we should live. It might explain some dryness about our mechanical evolution and our sociobiology, but it's not soul satisfying what science is. As much as I love it and it gives me purpose, I feel like people are starting to feel failed by science because the world's getting worse. Science isn't helping make the world get better in some of the fundamental ways. It isn't a lot of cosmetic, logistical ways, but overall, it still feels like we're heading to hell in a handbasket.
Well, John and I deal a lot with technology. Is technology going to save us? It kind of feels like, we've gotten all these cool things, but spiritually, we're pretty much where we started out. It didn't seem to have provided, it's a distraction, but it's not an answer.
I think that's the perfect way to describe it, that it's not going to solve these problems, but it can be helpful tools, perhaps. I had a sci-fi idea that I sent to Eric not too long ago, and this is free thrown out there. I don't have time to write out my sci-fi ideas, so I give them free to the world. But the idea that you might take an AI that's been trained on something like the raw material and the spiritist material and combine it and also train it on the QAnon material, which was so amazing, infecting people's heads. And that AI is given a Twitter account. And that Twitter account becomes the most influential Twitter account on the planet and changes vast swaths of our geopolitics. And I think that dark view of what could happen will also be counteracted by a light view. I think that there will be AI who will be helpful in helping when people figure out something about life. There's already AI who's doing some really beautiful writing when working with people. And so I think there are tools here that might help us in some kind of way, but the tools aren't really necessary. I like them because I like technology and I think all of this is fascinating and I'm curious to see what AI will do, but we don't actually need any of this stuff. It might make us slightly more efficient at it, but it probably for a lot of people, it's gonna make us worse as our attentions drift to, you know, cat photos.
A shovel doesn't do you much good if you can't figure out how to dig, right?
Yeah, Yes, exactly.
I mean, a tool is just a tool, right?
Mm-hmm. What are we going to use these tools for? Yeah.
So where UFOs are concerned, there's this extraterrestrial hypothesis, and I kind of get the sense you're not resonating too much with the extraterrestrial idea. Is that correct?
I'd say I do now. But I think it's completely different than what it mostly gets made out to be. I've started following along on UFO Twitter just last year or two to watch it, and it's just mostly depressing. People are looking to the government for answers. They're always talking about disclosure with a capital D of the Department of Defense finally fessing up with all with what it knows. But I suspect it doesn't know that much. I suspect they have a bunch of videos of stuff, and they know that UFOs appear around nuclear facilities. They appear around nuclear submarines and things like that, that they have more footage than we realize. But if you don't believe in this stuff, just look up the Tic Tac video. You know, it's the big release in the last couple of years. It's a video of a UFO from a Navy ship with a whole bunch of radar to confirm that it was there. There's plenty of evidence. If you don't if you had nothing but what the Department of Defense has released already, you know there's stuff up there that we don't understand so far. But I don't think they understand it. I don't think that they're secretly working with any kind of alien entities to help run the planet. I think that they have this secret that they didn't want to let out in the 50s because it was scary, and they didn't want to admit that there were entities that had better technologies that we couldn't stop. And they also, very clear, Department of Defense also used this as a as counterintelligence to hide their secret, some of their secret test programs. On the extraterrestrial question, I might defer to the raw material. I think it's worth reading for people. And their idea is that there isn't good and evil. That's something that you kind of get beyond and realize is two sides of the same coin. But there is service to self, and there's service to others. And they're both ways to advance, because each of us are a piece of the Godhead. We each have that inside us. Like Jesus said, ye are gods. And the idea that there are entities out there that have advanced through service to self, and they can come here if they're invited as well. But there's more entities that are service to others. And there's a whole bunch of entities out there that will come if we ask, and that it's operating on different dimensions than what we think of. The idea that there might be three dimensions of time instead of just one dimension of time, and that that's the reason that some of these UFOs can flick in and out of existence. You can be looking at one, it just goes away. It's a little bit like Edwin Abbott's Flatland. Our three-dimensional mind can't quite understand how these things are coming in and out. They're not nearly as physical as we think they are. And some part of that makes sense to me, because with dark matter and dark energy, where science is well aware, we can't see most of the universe. 90% of the universe is invisible. Maybe that's the spirit world. Maybe that's where all of these entities live. I don't know, but I've seen enough people who've had these experiences with other entities that are believable that I don't want to dismiss it. I want to keep reading about it, because it seems true and it seems fascinating. It seems like it could have importance for how we actually live our lives.
Well, the perceptions we have are the perceptions we need to live and survive here on Earth, right? And those perceptions are limited. There's bound to be a lot that we don't see. I mean, we know that. We know that there's more to the color spectrum than we can see. We know that there's more sound than we can hear. So who knows? And I guess that's probably a good place for us to wrap. Who knows?
Who knows? The way to be.
Thank you for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back. I'm sure there's a lot more we could talk about.
Okay, that sounds great. Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. I'd be glad to be back anytime.
Sure, we'll ping you again in a while, and we'll do it again.
Okay, sounds great.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.